Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. Well, as you know, I've been kind of homebound for the last couple of years, and I'm just starting to travel again. And in April and May, I had the wonderful opportunity to be in the UK, and I met a lot of wonderful people there and a lot of great new Reiki faces, which is always wonderful for the show. And one of these faces and people that I met that I was just very intrigued with was a woman by the name of Carolyn Rogers, who lives in London, and I'm really happy to be able to have her on the show today. Carolyn, thank you for being with us, and welcome.
Thank you, Phyllis. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And of course, like all the other interviews, I would really love it if you would share with us your Reiki story, how you met Reiki, the changes that happened in your life, and what brought you to the place that you are now.
Okay. Well, I first came in contact with Reiki sort of 8 or 9 years ago. A friend told me about it, that she'd heard about this. And as soon as she mentioned it, just a light bulb went on in my head. And I thought, that's for me. That's what I really want to, that really feels right. I didn't know why, but I just really strongly felt right. So I thought, I've got to find out a bit more about this. And probably most people would have gone for a treatment, which would seem sensible looking back, but no. I asked my sister for a book for Christmas. So she bought me a book by Krishni Borang, who's actually now my Reiki master.
Oh, and really? Oh, wow.
Yes. And I devoured the book. I was completely just wrapped by this Reiki business. So the next step for me was find out how shall I learn it? Still not having a treatment. So I signed up at my local college to learn it, and came to the date to come and sign up for the class, and they said, we're really sorry, but we signed that class up yesterday, you got the wrong information. So I was very disappointed, but then I thought, no, I'll have a look at, I'll see if I can find this Krishni person. And she's Swedish, and she just happened to be in London at the time, so, and she didn't happen to be that far away from me, so I went and got my initiation with Krishni, which was absolutely wonderful. And
wonderful.
In retrospect, that highly preferable for me to do that rather than go for a 10-week college course. So that was a wonderful experience. In fact, through the whole weekend, I think I laughed all the way through the weekend. It was such a good feeling. So, yeah, that's how I met Reiki. And I think, I would have had my first Reiki treatment then, while I was learning the hand positions. And I utterly owned it. It just felt really like what I should be doing.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So then I got on and I practiced it around myself, my friends, my family. It was amazing. And then I progressed to Reiki 2. I was desperate to do that, and I did that. And shortly after the second degree Reiki, I herniated a disc in my back, and I was lying prone for 3 months, which I must felt very much like a lesson from the universe. I had to lie there and really sort out loads of things about my life in my mind while receiving Reiki and giving myself Reiki. And one of the amazing things there was I didn't need any painkillers. I just put Reiki on myself all the time, all through that 3 months, and I didn't need any painkillers. And it was a real period of personal development.
Wow, that is amazing. How did your doctors feel about that? Did they mention that at all or comment on it?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes. At first, they thought they must have misdiagnosed it because I wasn't in enough pain, which is something that I've experienced that a lot over the past few years. We must have got it wrong. It's healed too quickly. I was not enough pain. So, yeah, that was a first major experience of using Reiki on myself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, yeah, then, like I say, it really felt like it was for me. So as I was coming out of that period, I started to treat more people locally, And I had a very strong sense of, I would like to do this. I would like to get out there and be a practitioner in some small way, which I did. And in a very Reiki way, somebody contacted me and said, how would you like to work in my business, practicing Reiki from my business? And I said, well, funny you should say that. It's just what I've been thinking about. So right. I did.
And what business was that, if I may ask?
It was a personal training studio. So it was a place where people were getting physically fit.
Oh, yes.
And so it was a complementary side to that. And that's where I got my first public experience working in there.
Wonderful.
Which was great fun and a real learning curve. Yeah.
And then when did the idea occur to you to become a master?
It was brewing in me all the time. It was something that I didn't want to sort of, I saw the weight of it, and I didn't, it's something I wanted to take as a process. I knew that was calling eventually, but it wanted to be, it, I could see that it needed to be a slow, steady process, because this Reiki business was, you know, it's so profound, and I could see that I'd only scratched the tiniest surface. So I said to my Reiki master that I'd like to be a master, but I hold a lot of respect for that title, and I haven't fully grown into it yet. But so that was a process. And in fact, I did have my master initiation, I think it was 3 years ago now. I went to go and visit Krishni in Sweden and stayed with her for a week. And rather wonderfully, her master, Vanya Twan, also turned up during that week and was part of my initiation. So it was a very magical week.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yes. On that little island in off Sweden.
Right.
It was very magical. I haven't started teaching yet, but that will come in its own time.
Uh-huh. Well, that's really amazing. I'm laughing because, of course, I know Wanya really well, and I just love her, to see her in her, what I call her natural environment. I feel like when she's in Sweden, it's like she's surrounded by people, if I may call her, like her. And she doesn't seem so out of place. And it's just wonderful to be with her. She's got great stories and
oh, she
great
has,
energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was just absolutely wonderful to be with her and Krishni, and also her daughter-in-law, Michelle, which I hadn't met before. She was just lovely.
Oh,
so,
she is
yes.
a very lovely woman. Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful experience that was, which
that was
I will never forget, as they say.
I can imagine. So have you felt a difference? Since you haven't been teaching, I'm just wondering, have you felt a difference after being initiated as a master? And, you know, I know that there are lots of expressions of mastery, and I'm just, that's what I'm getting to, I think, in my question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I think about the past 8 years for me have been an incredibly transformative and deepening process. And in fact, I did come, it was a similar kind of period that I've been involved actively with Buddhist practice. I'd been interested in Buddhism for, you know, since my teens, but actually to come into sort of relationship with the community as well. So I would, those two sort of very coincidentally or not go completely in parallel. And yes, it never stays static. It's never plateaus. It just gets deeper and broader and deeper and broader. So I would say that my experience constantly has been like that since actively getting involved with Reiki and the Buddhist community. It's a bit hard to separate the two because they're both transformative.
Tell me a bit about your Buddhist path then. You know, like, how did you get into Buddhism, and what kind of Buddhism are we speaking about? Because, you know, in my upbringing, all of my relatives were Buddhists, but they were what I would call Japanese Buddhists, which is looks very different on the outside. I mean, the nature of the study is the same, but the outward trappings are very different than Tibetan Buddhism or Chinese Buddhism or Indian Buddhism, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm involved with the Tri Ratna community, which used to be the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And I suppose the sort of particularity of this particular group of people is that, what Sangrachta, the founder, has tried to do, and I think does incredibly effectively, and what very much attracted me to it, is just try and get back to the core of the teachings. Because you can see Buddhism, obviously, it's translated very well around the world, and it's come with its own sort of cultural identity in whatever country it comes to. So right. What a particular group of people that I, or a community that I'm involved with, the emphasis is very much on getting to the essence of the teachings and separating the cultural aspects of it to some degree, finding out what's a practice suitable for us as Westerners, really. So you wouldn't particularly call it one type of Buddhism. It's like the back to basics Buddhism. It's drawing from, it has a lot of Tibetan lineage, it has Indian, Japanese and Chinese lineage within it, but it's drawing from everything.
Wow, really, that's interesting. And I've been to I had the wonderful opportunity to go to the Buddha Center in North London, and is really supported, obviously, by a very large community. And I'm just interested in your, let's see, I don't know, I'll ask questions, and if you feel like you can't answer them because they're too private or it's not appropriate, just let me know. Yeah. But in my limited understanding of Buddhism, there are three main tenets or pillars of the practice. There's the teaching, then there's your practice, and then there's your community.
Yes.
And I found that in the center, all three of these were fairly obvious. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
About the teaching, the
about these
community.
Three, yeah, and the role of the community in this.
Well, I mean, firstly, you know, just broadening community slightly, I mean, I found that rather wonderful to have that Reiki meeting that we all had in the Buddhist center, which I practice, which I practice in.
Right.
And that, you know, that really made me think about community as well, having the experience of a Reiki community like that. I suppose we think when we make our commitment to Buddhist practice, we tend to go to the formal ways, to go to refuge, to the Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment, and the aspiration, the Dharma, the teaching, or the natural law, and the Sangha, the community of practitioners, and the past and present. So, Sangha, community, is a very important part. And for me, it's the experience, like Reiki, of getting together. We often get together, I get together with my other community members for study on a weekly basis. I get together for meditating together, going on retreat occasionally, or meditation days, just socially to discuss. At the moment, I'm in a group where we're really looking at our ethical practice and coming back regularly to discuss how our ethical practice has gone over the past couple of weeks, for example. So it's an incredibly supportive environment, and it hothouses your practice as well. So it can be supportive, and it can also challenge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being around more experienced practitioners has just been fantastic for their sort of insights, just to point directly at times to what is going on, and very insightful. Mm-hmm. But just that experience, you know, just simply meditating together, it's a very different experience meditating in a group than it is as an individual. Mm-hmm. It's really amplified, like when we all do Reiki in a large room together, for example. Well, the experience is very much amplified. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's how it currently works for me as regard the community in a practical sense.
Right. Well, my ears kind of perked up when you were talking about this discussion group you're having now about ethical practice, and I'm going, well, what does that mean, you know, in relationship to a Buddhist practice? So I'm interested in What does that really mean? I mean,
practically, on a practical... Yeah. Well,
Yes, go ahead.
Well, as in a Buddhist context, when we commit to the Buddhist path, we agree to abide, or at least attempt to our best effort to abide by particular precepts. So, for example, for one of the precepts is a speech precept, to be truthful in your speech. So, for example, I find this an interesting process, because with mindfulness and an awareness to be of what you're speaking, it's gradually refined what I say. There'd be much more subtle things I notice aren't entirely truthful, or something that I might not have thought as important. Now, with the focus of attention on it, I realise these are very subtle little ways in which I'm exaggerating or not being truthful in some way, or maybe I've spoken rather harshly, and before that wouldn't particularly matter, it would just pass, but now with a spotlight on it, I can refine the attention to my speech, and it's a continuing process, and the more attention that we're paying to it, and I'm paying to it, the more I see the effect that it has, either that the effect that my kindly speech has, for example, where before I might have not thought that made an awful lot of effect. Now, with more attention on it, I can see the extended effect that it has. So how the form that it's taking at the moment in the ethical practice is to look at those five basic precepts about generosity, kindness, mindfulness, truthful speech, and stillness and simplicity. Now that I can measure my actions and my intentions by those five things and gradually refine them, it has an extra weight doing it in conjunction with other people. One of the things that we do, or that we've decided to do lately, although it's not necessary, but that's what we've decided to give a go, so we wanted to, is confession. So there'll be small details that we've, because we're shining the light of attention onto it, it feels rather more weighty. So if we can confess, not in a sort of a guilt-laden way, but just in a kind of letting it go way, actually, that just the act seems to put some more weight between letting it go and committing to not doing that sort of thing again, or just being more attentive, really. So that's the sort of format that it's taking at the moment. And it seems to, again, like all of these things, have an effect that's much more than the sum of its parts. I'm finding it incredibly useful, and it's moving something quite deep in me that I'm not really able to verbalise at the moment what that is exactly, but it seems to have set off some real sort of deep process somewhere. So I'm interested to see where it goes. And like I say, it's got nothing to do with guilt and that kind of negative emotions. It's just to do with positive transformation. So
would another word for this process that you call confession, which is fine, be like acknowledging something, like being able to acknowledge it and witness it, and in that yes. witnessing, then the energy of what you've done takes on a different context, and you can hold yes. it in a way with compassion for yourself as well as for the other person.
Absolutely. One of the sort of foundation practices in Buddhism is the metta practice. Metta is an ancient Pali word for loving kindness, as a real sort of active, strong force. And everything we do has to be absolutely suffused with metta to really hold it. So when I'm talking about confession, yes, it is. It's very much about acknowledgement, but it's about having that experience of remorse. Uh-huh. So you could acknowledge something, and there's various things that I acknowledge that I know are not sort of skillful, as we sometimes call it, rather than right or wrong. I know it's not necessarily skillful, but nevertheless, I don't feel bad about it. So that's interesting. I acknowledge that. Oh, I did that. Oh, good. I don't feel bad about it. That's right. Interesting. But yeah. What the actual confession part is at the point when you acknowledge something that was less than skillful, say, But there's also, and I experience very physically, a remorse element in there mm-hmm. as well. Ooh, that kind of, ooh, that gut feeling of that. It's not a big thing, but nevertheless, that has not sat well with my internal calibrations, if you like.
Right.
So as soon as that comes into play, it's like, right, let it go. That's gone. That's the sort of complete process at the moment. Yeah, and the process in doing it in conjunction with another person is that it's witnessed. There's something about it being witnessed, which I will understand more later, I imagine, but it's a very strong process to have it witnessed. It's not judged. No comments made about it ever. It's just that's what it is and it's witnessed.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Well, excuse me. In my work with people, we've done a lot of groups, and it's amazing the power of witnessing. It's like to be able to make a commitment to oneself is one thing, but there is a binding, there's a kind of energetic binding that happens when you're witnessed. And, you know, some people say, you know, react to that as being sort of trapped. And another perspective is to see that it is a way of openness, that there's something that happens within the person that allows you to use another person for your benefit rather than feeling trapped. And that's always an interesting one when we come into Reiki, for instance.
Well, I see it this stuff is you know, relatively new to me, and I realize that I'm not experienced, but that, you know, so far in what my experience with it is, it's like Reiki, it's the holding of a space. There's something really strong about the holding of a space, and I'm just amazed at just with that sort of agreement that we've made to hear each other's actions that we want to change, we want to acknowledge and change. It just opens up this space where anything can happen, really.
Right.
And it's very potent. For me, I don't find that binding at all. I find it really opens something else. It puts boundaries around something, then I can really let go. It pins it down, maybe. It pins the bottom of my kite down so my kite can really fly. Something like that.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that ethics has been really important for me in the practice of Reiki. I've found it's something that I've just found absolutely fundamental, because we do get into so many situations that are out of the normal.
Yes.
That we really need a very strong ethical framework of some sort to operate from. Not appropriating what's happening during treatments, for example.
Yes. Mm. What does that mean to you, not appropriating things that happen in treatments?
Well, for example, I worked for just coming up to 4 years in a central London hospital in a very an award delivering radical surgery, and it was very the experiences that people were having were really, you know, just with having their surgery, having their diagnosis. It was mostly cancer, but there's some serious assaults as well that I dealt with. Because of the intensity of their circumstances at that time, the types of surgery they were having, the diagnoses and prognosis that they were facing, the actual experience of Reiki would often be very, very intensive, much more strongly than somebody coming for a bit of relaxation, say.
Right, for sure.
So some rather extraordinary things would happen on a relatively regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just very aware at that point that, you know, they would often like treat me as if I'd just done something absolutely amazing. And I would be very, very careful to say it's Reiki, it's coming through me, I'm sort of a channel for it, but it's not actually me. You know, anybody can learn, this is the wonderful thing of it. I have taken a certain amount of effort and I have achieved a certain amount of things because I've taken the effort, but it is open to everybody. But I'm just very aware of the tendency to take ownership of what is happening, really.
Right.
So that's from the negative perspective of it. And the other side of it is that the less I take any ownership of it. And again, this mindfulness is very useful to see where I'm doing that. The less I can take ownership of it, the more I can let it flow through me, then the stronger the treatment is as well, or the deeper the experience.
Uh-huh,
so it's a real getting out of the way in the positive sense, and to, for the not appropriating any results. That does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Oh, that was wonderful, enlightening. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I sort of have two minds. I'm split. I would love to talk to you more about your hospital experience, but I want to go back to these discussions that you're having. And I know that in the world of Reiki, there are people, usually masters, who call together groups of Reiki students to do essentially the same thing with the five precepts and to study the five precepts. But I'd love to, you know, if somebody is listening and you do this, I would love to hear from you and interview
me
you
too.
For the show
yes.
because I'd love to find out the result of this, because people have had some amazing experiences with the five precepts, using them as an ethical foundation for their lives and for their practice. And I feel like these precepts grow in us as we enlarge the context of our practice. And, you know, out of the context of our practice, they just seem like these basic rules that maybe no one wants to really obey. And it's not about obedience. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that, because there's this quality, I think, of the Western world to see precepts and these kinds of things, like the Ten Commandments, to be things that we obey. And it's very hard to put in words. It's not really guidance, because it's stronger than guidance. But anyway, do you have something to say about what I'm fumbling around with?
I'm very aware that I'm speaking with from my own limited experience, which obviously is all I can speak from, but I've got some thoughts just about how I've come in relationship to the precepts, to the Buddhist precepts. I mean, also just to say that I'm, you know, having sort of worked a little bit more deeply with the Buddhist precepts, I'm really interested, and I really want to look at the Reiki precepts, and just to delve a bit in that. So I'm very, there they are, they're sitting there, and I haven't paid much attention to them because I've been looking at the Buddhist precepts. So that's an area of interest that I'm going to grow into, I think, quite soon. But how I come into a relationship with the Buddhist precepts, I mean, they've been presented to me from the start as very much that they're not commandments. In fact, one of the sort of ways that we phrase them is, I undertake the training principle of doing no harm, for example. So for me, I like that expression, the training principle. And because I've come into relationship with Buddhism, but at first, when I read Dharma books, I read books about Buddhism. And the more I read, the more I had the experience of something in me is really resonating strongly. And I believe this is true for me. What is saying, I don't always understand it all, but there's something resonates in me that tells me it's true. And what's happened over the years as I've put more and more into practice is that I've been given confidence and trust in that, because I've done these certain practices. And all along in Buddhism, they're framed very much in a suck it and see kind of way. Try it out. If it doesn't work for you, that's okay. In fact, one of the things of the Buddha is that the Dharma is whatever takes you towards enlightenment. It doesn't have to be one thing in particular. There's lots of things. So test it out. So from testing it out, there's been a lot of things that have worked over the years. And I've got a lot of faith, not in terms of blind faith, but confidence and trust and a sense that it's really working. So when I'm given these set of principles precepts, I undertake the training principle too. I take it very much in the spirit of, well, I've been doing a lot of things that have been suggested to me that I found have really worked. Let's take these on. I have a very large degree of trust. In fact, in what the Buddha has given us as teaching so far. So if the Buddha suggests that, you know, try doing no harm and see what effect that has, I'm willing to take that on. Mm-hmm. I take it, you can take them on in a kind of provisional way, kind of play with them, experiment with them, try it, test it out.
Right.
So that's kind of the spirit in which I've taken them. And like you say, if you're maybe reciting them every day, they take on their own life and their own growth.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. Uh-huh. But I know for other people that, you know, maybe coming from a more sort of dogmatic religious background, then it can seem like another set of commandments. But my personal relationship to them is, yeah, let's test it out. It sounds good to me.
Great. Wonderful. Well, you know, having the five precepts in my life and seeing how they've applied to my life in just very mundane ways and also in very profound ways, I've realized that my attitude toward the Ten Commandments, for instance, has really changed. It's matured. And I just see that there is this, I don't know, maybe it's just my personality, but, you know, when told what to do, my first instinct is don't do it, right? And I hope that I'm growing out of it. I'm 63 and I'm, you know, going on 64 this year, I hear. I had to ask a friend of mine, how old am I going to be this year in August? And I was appalled to find out that I was going to be 64. And anyway, I just see that, of course, we're human. And what's important to acknowledge as human beings is not just our imperfections, so i.e. the confession part of our religious background, but this other piece where we are also perfect. And I realize that in some way the Ten Commandments give us a possibility of not saying, well, you know, you're totally, you totally probably won't be able to do this, but here are these commandments. I find them to say, now, here is a way to live, and I know you can do it. And that particular shift of perspective is an amazing difference in my life and also in the way that I see and take on the wisdom of other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's also when you see it more as an aspiration, something you're aspiring towards, rather than something you've got to achieve right now today, and you've failed at if you haven't. I find it sounds like you're saying a little bit something like that as well. You're talking about sort of a confidence that you're very capable of doing that.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like I feel like when my grandmother used to talk about the five precepts. She didn't say it in a I didn't get the message. Well, you probably won't ever be able to do this, but this is what I want you to do.
Yeah.
She gave it to us, gave us these five precepts, saying, you know, aspire to them. I know you can do it. And with the help of Reiki, this is what you can change your life through these. And I think that this is very much what you're doing. And instead of just waiting for it to happen in your discussion groups, you're really putting your oar in the water, as I would say.
Yeah.
And you're doing more than just waiting around, you know, for it to happen. You're actually providing impetus and movement and awareness that will perhaps, we could say, multiply your understanding and the effect that these wise sayings, if we could call them that, have on your personal life.
Yes. That sounds a very good way to put it.
Yeah.
And also just to sort of restate that it's not a negative experience, like confession, to use that word, doesn't have the sort of negative connotations of guilt that it might in other places.
Right.
In fact, you know, it's a very joyous occasion when you can actually let go of something, no matter how small. It doesn't feel negative. It feels very joyous to, number one, see like that and let go.
Uh-huh.
But also, I think thinking about out sort of the other side of that with Reiki as well, because you're talking about aspiring, or we're talking about aspiring to these precepts or commandments, whatever they are. Right. I think, you know, I've particularly found giving Reiki is very much at times, you know, I suppose particularly working with members of the public, that you, when the person comes in the room or you come to a patient in the hospital scenario, you may like them more or less. Some people you might be actually repulsed by, some people you might think are wonderful, but as soon as that Reiki flows, there's an experience of love for whoever the person is, and a connection, I suppose, with love in the universe, and a much more a universal experience, and all those prejudices and all those different things that gets, those different types of veils that gets in the way of your perception of actual experience, or experience as it really is, as you know, often is said. Reiki very much lifts those veils away, so you can see much more clearly what's going on in that kind of, as you were saying before, the nature of us that really is perfect already. I think I've had very, very wonderful experiences with that, having those sort of veils temporarily drawn, mm-hmm. Drawn away, and to be able to see with, you know, the eyes of really big love, I suppose.
Yes.
So that's been very profound, to have those experiences kind of directly given to me through Reiki without having to work at it.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, I feel like that is one of the gifts of Reiki. It's,
yes, absolutely.
It's like to be put in these situations where we have the actual experience ourselves, and we don't have to try to borrow the experience from other people.
Absolutely.
One of the most disappointing books that I read that actually has proven to be accurate in my book was a book of readings by Krishnamurti, and he said in several of his talks to people, he said, well, you know, one of the disappointments about being human is that we don't learn from each other's experience. We have to have it ourselves. And so one of the amazing things and the gifts for me about Reiki is that it allows us to have and be aware of the experiences as we are experiencing it, and then be able to extrapolate that into the rest of our lives. And that is, you know, a true gift for me of walking on this path of healing that
Absolutely.
We're on.
That experience for me is extraordinary, like coming into in the context of a Buddhist community, all these things I was learning about compassion, equanimity, sympathetic joy, and loving kindness, for example, which are one particular set of practices.
Uh-huh.
We could work at generating these in meditation with a various amount of success, but then to be able to go to my Reiki practice and these experiences just spontaneously occur, in situations that at times were absolutely dire, that, you know, I couldn't imagine worse situations at times. And suddenly, out of the blue, this enormous equanimity would just pervade everywhere, and I'd know that everything and everybody was just as it was meant to be. So to go from the study and the sort of very tentative attempts to gain some of this during meditation, to bam, being given the experience right there and its hugeness. It was extraordinary. And to have this Dharma, the Buddhist teaching, as a framework to experience that, it's just been extraordinary, really.
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, it's
beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wonderful. Well, now I'm going to guide us to another facet of your Reiki experience, which is you as a practitioner. And I understand
Yes.
that you have had extensive work, as you have alluded to, in the hospital setting. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. I don't know where to start. And also, in the sense that there are a lot of people now who are looking at becoming Reiki practitioners in what I would call a public setting. And it's different to go to the hospital because your friend is there and you want to support them. And by the way, you know, you do Reiki, or you're there simply to do Reiki treatments, but it's your friend. So it's different than actually going into a hospital and treating people who might want a Reiki practitioner, but you don't necessarily know them. So I don't know in which instance you went to the hospitals, and maybe both. So
yeah, that's my first question. If I could give you I could talk a little bit about what the setup was that I worked in. If you
like. Yeah, that'd be great.
I cast my mind back because I left just over a year ago. So I cast my mind back to then. I mean, the situation that we were, it was a central London hospital that I worked in. We were part of a complementary therapy team. We were NHS employees with some funding from charitable places. And my job was, I worked on a particular ward. I worked largely on head and neck, which was mostly about head and neck cancers, but there was other things occasionally. And latterly, I worked with children and teenagers with cancer as well. So I was part of a multidisciplinary team. I was the only therapist on the ward, which was an interesting experience coming in, because a lot of the medics or the staff didn't know about Reiki. And although there was some enthusiasm, there was some scepticism there as well. So I felt it was quite educational, not directly, but for people to gradually observe the effects over time. Mm-hmm. So the way it worked, people could be referred to me, but more largely what I did is I went up onto the ward and bed by bed introduced myself to the patients, had a little chat as quickly as possible, built some kind of rapport, and offered them a session. So most of the people on the ward had never heard of Reiki. It was not within their sort of lifestyle what they might have come across, which I found that really enjoyable, to be able to introduce Reiki to people who would never normally come across it. So by and large, there'd be a lot of scepticism, but also an openness in these particular situations that was so critical to try something. So people very often did try something. We'd do a session and, you know, it would have really strong results quite a lot of the time. So eventually that would be fed back. Patients would go away and feed it to their relatives, their friends, say to the staff they had this very strong effect. You know, be it at times pain morphine couldn't relieve, Reiki could. Not all the time, but, you know, regularly enough to make an impact. And the impact on fear and anxiety was huge. You know, patients waiting to have these radical surgeries, or being given very difficult prognoses, or end-of-life situations, it was just fantastic for, really, to enable to give a wider perspective, really, to touch into a bit of that, even if only briefly, a real sense of real sort of spacious equanimity, to be able to touch a bit of that instead of this intense fear. Was very beneficial. So yes, that would be my daily routine. I would go up on the ward, introduce myself round. I'd keep notes in their medical notes underneath the physiotherapist visit and the surgeon's visit. There'd be a little note from me saying I'd done this, and yes, we're fully integrated, and that's how it worked.
That's quite amazing.
It's extraordinary,
and extraordinary that they would allow you to do that. I mean,
yes,
that's really forward thinking. I'm really amazed. So I know that you've left the program, and if you want to share why that was, maybe just time constraints or whatever, but I'm really interested to know if the program is still going and what the kind of results were after this year that you had with them.
Well, I was there, for nearly 4 years.
4 years. Oh, wow.
Yeah. There is a program, there is a team still there, and there's still Reiki happening there. But what they're doing, this is another issue, as I'm sure you're very aware of, but there's a lot of volunteers in these sort of areas. And I think organisations are sort of really finding that volunteers are there by the hundreds, willing to provide their services. So things were often tending to go more down that route rather than employed staff, which I think is problematic, but that's another subject. So that's still happening there. But myself and three of my other Reiki colleagues from the hospital, we decided that we'd really like to get together and set up a similar service outside of the hospital, because there was a real large need we found from the patients, a lot of patients who benefited so much from having Reiki, who wanted to have it outside of the hospital when they left or during, in between treatments. But it's very difficult to get in touch with people with a relevant experience.
Right.
Or, so what we've decided is that we all sort of feel very passionately about delivering this service and delivering it very well. So we're just in the process of setting up a service in North London, although hopefully we'll reach a bit further than North London. To, you know, as people who've worked in, and two of us still do work in that context, but just providing it outside the hospital, which I'm very excited about.
Well, that's great.
I mean, really positive about that.
A way to continue their Reiki experience, you know, outside of the hospital, which I think, you know, for the most part is really great, since they tend to dismiss people out of the hospital on some level really soon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And having some kind of continuum of treatment seems like that would be really a great idea.
And also it's quite limited, although it's incredibly valuable what you can do in hospital. It's by nature largely limited by people going in and out. Although in certain departments, haematology, for example, patients often stay for a very long time. But you get the sense of people being introduced to something that's really opening up a much wider world for them.
Uh-huh.
And it'd be very nice for them to be able to access that outside of the hospital. And we're trying to get funding for this at the moment. So we've got some interest from a couple of charities in funding. So we really want to make it accessible to everybody. Which is something I particularly liked about working within the NHS.
Right.
Wasn't dependent on means. It really was completely accessible.
Right. Wonderful. Good for you. Well, I'd love to hear what goes on with that, because I don't know if you know this, but now in in the UK, there is now starting to be a register for Reiki practitioners, and that opens up a whole nother field of discussion. And
it certainly does, yes.
And I imagine that you have some fairly strong opinions about that. Is that true?
Yes. I've certainly got some thoughts on that, yes.
Oh, good. Well, we won't talk about it now because it's we're almost finished with our time. But yeah. I would love to connect with you later on about that, because I've been asked to come and do a public practitioner training course next year for people who do the system. And it is my opinion that people need more than first and second degree to start really going into public venues and doing treatment, because there's a higher standard of care for me.
Yes.
In going into places where you don't have this familial kind of network system. So, for instance, in the folk art, what I call the folk art practice, we treat our family and friends. So there's always some personal connection that we have with the people that we treat. And here, you're going into a ward of strangers and introducing Reiki and, you know, trying to be able to give them the scope of what Reiki could give them, but at the same time not dissuading them. So it's kind of interesting, and there are skills involved in doing that, and awarenesses involved that I feel like takes someone to be told that, and then it'll open up this whole other window or framework of Reiki practice.
This is somewhere I feel, again, something I feel very strongly about, for us as practitioners to go into these public places There is so much I've learned from working around the hospital about protocols and how you speak about things, what you might mention, what you might not mention. How do you deal with it when somebody says their dead relative's just come and appeared in front of them?
Right.
How do you deal that with that as an NHS worker? Or how do you deal with all kinds of unusual things that might emerge that don't generally emerge for people delivering NHS treatment, for example?
Right. There's
an extraordinary amount of areas that you really need to be aware of, and which everybody can be. Everybody can do it. But it's about a bit of training, I think.
Yes.
Some awareness of how things work or how to approach people.
Right.
How to deliver your therapy to somebody who can't speak English and has no translator.
Right.
How to deliver your therapy to somebody who's, I mean, a couple of times I had one patient who is deaf and blind.
Oh, wow. There's
all kinds of very interesting scenarios, or people who can't speak, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think these are very useful to discuss in advance how you operate in a particular setting.
Right, right.
And how you just interact with other members of staff in that kind of setting.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly. And not feel arrogant and not come across as being less than, but somehow being collegial. Yeah. And I think that's really difficult.
Yes, it takes a... Well, yes, it's a certain balance, isn't it?
Yes, I think
being
so.
Because we're used to talking in a certain type of way about Reiki,
right,
and about all our wonderful experiences that we have. And it's all very flowery and, you know, it's very particular, isn't it?
Right.
But when you take it into a public service space where people either don't know about Reiki, they're not interested, they don't want to hear all your flowery hippie stuff. They want to know how their patients are going to benefit.
Right.
They want to know, sort of, you know, down the line, ordinary, straightforward talk about what this is and how it's going to be delivered. I think it's quite something for us as, and I won't speak for everybody, but largely speaking in a certain kind of very flowery, intangible way at times about Reiki. It's quite a practice to nail it all down and be able to have a professional conversation with another member of a multidisciplinary team, for example.
Yeah. Without giving away the essence of Reiki.
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
That's really a tough one. Well, I look forward to having more extended conversation with you about this particular topic. But now I would really like to move us into closure and say that some of the topics that you're bringing up now about public practice and the work that you've been doing with your ethical thing, I see a tie-in, and that is about conscious listening. That's like, you know, you're listening to yourself, but also listening to what you've created and listening to what other people create in their lives through the work of the precepts or through your not working with the precepts, creates a kind of listening modality that I feel like you can go into a public practice with, and then you hear people not with your own filters of what would it be like to be dying, or what would it be like to be ill, or what would it be like to be in the hospital, but to really listen to what the person is asking or what the person is wanting from you, and being able to respond in a way that doesn't come from reaction but comes from compassion.
Yes.
And I find that this thread of conscious listening that you are embarked upon and are deeply engaged in really inspiring. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Phyllis. In fact, one of the largest things I've got, I feel has been my practice with Reiki, is getting out of the way and getting into this space of, well, very deeply affirming people as well by that listening.
Mm-hmm.
And through the practice of meditation, where you learn to sit with your own discomfort and difficulty, in turn being able to sit with somebody else's discomfort and difficulty, whatever that may be, and to be able to enter this into this mutual healing space from that commitment to really be present with another person. And that is certainly something that I'm finding is requiring a lot of development. But that has been, I suppose, the essence of it for me so far. The alleviation of suffering in whatever form.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.